Welcome to A State of Readiness, a podcast set as a fireside chat with business leaders to discuss what it takes for a company to be in a state of readiness and become a high-performance organization with your host, Joseph Paris. Welcome, everybody. This is Joseph Paris, and I'd like to welcome our audience to another episode of State of Readiness. Today, our guest is James Considine, and James is the Chief of Staff and Head of Business Programs for the Aging and Caregiving Business at Philips, where he oversees the Enterprise PMO, Continuous Improvement and Engineering Reporting and Analytics. He hails from upstate New York, just north of Albany, where it used to be my old stomping grounds, beautiful part of the world there, between Albany and in Lake George. If you ever get a chance, I highly recommend it. And it's especially wonderful in August, late July and August in Saratoga, where the races are and all the beautiful people and the fancy hats. Welcome, James. How are you doing today?
Doing great. Glad to be here.
Yeah, I'm glad you could join us today. It's been a while in coming. You and I going back, trying to organize it for about 3 months or so, isn't it?
I think that's when we first connected on this topic. Yeah.
Yeah. Super. So, tell me a little bit about your journey there. How did you get to Philips? And you know, of course, I know that GE was born and bred in upstate New York there, and Schenectady had a gigantic footprint. But how did you come to be in the greater Albany area?
Sure. So I ended up going to college here at the University of Albany and graduated in the early 90s and just wound up staying, much to my amazement, quite honestly. A lot of my peers and cohorts were looking to leave and go back to where they came from. I'm originally from downstate New York. And turned out this was a pretty nice place to start a life and start a career and have a family. And I've just been here ever since. So, you know, my degree is in philosophy. I thought I wanted to be a professional philosopher. Turns out that corporate pays better than philosophy, and wound up, you know, starting my career in communications first, then in technology, IT project management, and about 15 years ago, found myself moving into the energy business, which is where I caught the Lean Six Sigma continuous improvement bug, if you will, and that's been a big part of my, you know, journey ever since, is different sort of iterations of evolving that tool set, you know, being involved in various continuous improvement type roles, operational roles, which have brought me to where I am today. In terms of Philips, I was actually specifically recruited out of General Electric because I had General Electric Lean Six Sigma black belt experience, and that's what they were looking for at the time. And I wanted to be in a sector where, you know, I could really see my work every day impacting the lives of others in a positive way. And healthcare seemed to be really the best place that I could try to apply my talents in that direction. So I've been with Philips ever since, had a few different roles there, starting out in medical imaging, and now from last year, moving into our aging and caregiving business.
So, you know, that's quite a, you know, transition from philosophy to operational excellence and continuous improvement, wouldn't you think? Or is there a connection there?
Well, you know, I think as I've kind of gone through this over time, I do think there's a pretty significant connection there. If they called degrees in philosophy degrees in critical thinking, I'd probably have the world being a path to my door, because I think in this day and age, critical thinking is a critical skill that is not necessarily ubiquitous, especially in some of the disciplines that are in favor today. Some of the highly technical disciplines and so on and so forth may not necessarily expose you to the type of abstract critical thought that philosophy kind of makes its bones on. So
yeah, I see that connection. You know, when you're looking at continuous improvement, you know, you're questioning everything. You know, why is it done this way? Why do these people engage in this manner? And by the way, we want to get them to embrace a change. So how do we then get them to see the benefit as it relates to themselves? So yeah, I mean, I personally see the connection a great deal, because at the end of the day, it's all about, you know, people, right? I mean,
exactly. And that's kind of been my sort of proclivity ever since. You know, I'm not an engineer, I'm not a software developer, so the bits and bytes are always going to be elusive to me. And yet, I think no matter what business you look at, whether it's an artificial intelligence startup or what have you, it's still people that ultimately need to work with machines in order to deliver the value. And in a lot of places still, it's people that are delivering the actual value a lot of times. And so I don't know that we're necessarily at a point in our history where, you know, people can basically sit on the beach all day and let machines do things for us. People are very much involved in making everything go. And so that's kind of what I see when I walk through a factory, for example, is not machines, but I see the people working around the machines and trying to understand that interaction.
Mm-hmm. So what's been, you know, you came from or through GE. Mm-hmm. Were you there when Jack Welch was, making Six Sigma a cornerstone of his business operating system?
No, I joined after that, and I actually joined right before the financial crisis, so it was a pretty interesting time to be at GE while it was going through some of its stresses. At that time, it actually had kind of come and, I don't want to say come and gone, but it kind of was super important, then less important, and then became important again. And at the time that I was there, there were actually some kind of competing improvement methodologies. You had kind of the Six Sigma folks, then you had the Lean guys who were primarily in the factories, and then you had what we called kind of traditional quality folks who were very much in the compliance and auditing and QMS and kind of formalized root cause analysis world. And at the time at GE, you know, those groups were kind of a little bit siloed from each other and perhaps at times in conflict. But what I found is actually there is definitely an application for every one of those tools in the right circumstance. And, you know, again, perhaps going back to my sort of philosophical background and systems thinking, has turned out to be very useful in my current life to be able to reach for those specific tools in the right instances versus kind of falling prey to, I have a hammer, everything around me looks like a nail.
Yeah.
I tend more to look like, you know, I have screwdrivers and other things in my tool belt, and sometimes you need a hammer, sometimes you need a screwdriver. So it's good to have multiple tools.
Yeah, I agree with that. Absolutely. You know, 10 or 15 years ago, you know, you see on LinkedIn this big debate, you know, Lean versus Six Sigma. And, you know, to me, it all comes under the heading of operational excellence or continuous improvement, even. You know, if you're looking at, you know, improving processes, we're looking at continuous improvement. So I don't really care if it's, you know, theory of constraints or Lean or Six Sigma. I like to let the nature of the opportunity create a pull on the approach.
Absolutely.
So what has been some of the key success factors for your career, do you think?
Well, I think, you know, I would point to a couple of things that I seem to have been pretty good at doing on a repeated basis. I've had a number of roles where I was basically the first person to occupy that role. So rather than kind of stepping into an incumbent's shoes where there was something to pick up and run with or pivot away from or what have you, it really required kind of going back to first principles and observing what the need was around me and then creating a way to go fulfill that need. And a lot of the first steps that I found in pretty much every situation I've been in is the need to kind of structure and organize some very basic things in order to achieve alignment so that you know, everybody is clear on what the priorities are and that they're clear on how our key stakeholders are measuring us against those priorities, and that we have some sort of operating mechanism where we can course correct and see how we're doing against those topics. So the ability to kind of recognize that need and implement that fairly quickly has been almost a superpower, because, you know, one of the things I often say when I'm teaching lean and we talk about the wastes and so forth is the one that I believe is the biggest waste of all is what we call the eighth waste, which is basically human intellect. I see more and more kind of time, money, effort, energy wasted because roles and responsibilities and priorities are unclear than anything else, than mountains of inventory in a warehouse or what have you. So I really strive hard to fix that first and foremost. And then the second thing that, you know, again, I think going back to my upbringing in philosophy is the ability to kind of connect dots together and look across silos, look across disparate, you know, portions of an organization, and be able to start to make connections and connect people together, connect processes together in ways that perhaps aren't intuitive to others. And that's been something that's really been a common factor in all the roles I've had, is being able to and needing to do those two things in order to be successful.
So you know, in your current role, what's the most exciting thing? You know, what gets you your blood going? You know, every morning that you go to the office. You know, what's some of the more exciting things that you're involved with in your current role?
Sure. So, you know, my current role is pretty interesting in that I really have to operate in a lot of contexts all at once. So in addition to having, you know, kind of a PMO, which is engaged in running all sorts of projects from, you know, changing how we build to create, you know, managing the development and deployment of the next generation product, et cetera, you know, it really requires the ability to step in and out of different contexts all the time. And that, I guess, is something that I'm pretty good at, since I'm not necessarily a functional expert in any of the specific topic areas. It helps to be able to have that agility. But I think, you know, the big thing that's going on in my organization, and I think is probably, you know, worth spending some time on for your audience, is digital transformation. We're rapidly moving away from kind of a legacy way of operating to more of a platform as a service, software as a service construct, which not only gives a much better customer experience, it also allows us to realize, you know, not just incremental improvements in how we operate, but really step changes in how we operate. And the other exciting thing about that, too, is that it really opens up a pretty big world of opportunity, from business models to ecosystem partners to what have you, where you can start to connect things together because you have, you know, API-driven platforms and whatnot that in the past would be very, very difficult and very, very manual in order to create those type of opportunities. So I think, you know, you have a number of companies that are sort of cloud native, and a lot of the software startups are cloud native, and so they kind of operate this way from day one. And you have a number of companies that have been around a while who are trying to make the transition. And so I consider myself lucky that I get to be in the middle of that and leading that in a number of respects with my general manager, because I think it's a pretty unique opportunity to do all the things I just talked about in one job. I don't see a lot of opportunities necessarily left and right of me where you get all of that in one role.
So how do you, you know, digital transformation, you know, there's a lot of hype words going on. You know, there's the Internet of Things, there's AI, there's, you know, digital transformation. You know, how do you separate the dream from the reality?
That's a great question. I think, you know, and I'll be the first to admit, Philips in particular is a company that has it really hard-coded in its DNA a sort of technology innovation-led way of working, so that we kind of we introduce new technology that's, you know, incrementally improved or generations ahead of the last generation of technology. And, you know, that's worked for us for quite a while. I think the big difference that really all of us in business need to understand, especially in the digital world, is that it's really not enough to have the best thing, the best gadget, the best algorithm for a lot of customers if the experience that goes around that doesn't live up to their expectations. And in fact, what we see is a number of customers will take good enough if they are working with a partner, a business partner that gives them a good experience, gives them trust and confidence. So where the two things come together, I think, is that, you know, you can see a lot of smart people developing technology, solving, you know, sort of solutions in search of a problem, if you will. And then you see, you know, the ones that I believe are going to succeed in the marketplace, and that's what we want to do, is to really take an outside-in view and really understand what the problems are that our customers are dealing with, and then try to design, you know, technology, process, experience to solve those problems. It's a completely opposite approach from kind of a technology-led organization to being a marketing-led and sort of customer need-led organization. So there is a lot of hype out there with IoT and whatnot, and some of those things do, you know, especially in the beginning, do kind of take on the hallmark of solutions in search of a problem. Like, you know, why do I need my refrigerator to be connected to the internet, for example? It's cool that I can do it, but what's the use case? Like, why do I really need my refrigerator connected to the internet? And so I think it's an important filter for, you know, engineers everywhere to really step back and look at, you know, yes, I can do this. Should I do this? You know, what problem is it going to solve?
Yeah, in a previous article, I wrote about this this house that I live in here in Germany. It's completely automated, and it's not ergonomically designed at all. It was designed by somebody at, you know, maybe you know, the Wintel solutions rather than the Apple solutions. You know, mm-hmm. and I could go into that for forever, but this show's not about that, is it? We're going to take a break. You've been listening to James Considine, Chief of Staff and Business Head of Business Programs for the Aging and Caregiving at Philips, and we'll be back in a few moments after this break. This episode of State of Readiness, sponsored by the Operational Excellence Society, a think tank, a creator and aggregator of knowledge and know-how, serving businesses and professionals who wish to learn more on the various topics which combined comprise the discipline of operational excellence. Learn more at www.opexsociety.org. Welcome back, everybody. This is Joseph Paris, and with me I've got James Considine, Chief of Staff and Head of Business Programs for the Aging and Caregiving at Philips. Welcome back there, James.
Thanks, Joseph.
Good. So we're talking about you know, your career and some of the challenges you've faced and lessons learned. You know, let's talk a bit about the future. What are some of the most challenging and exciting topics that you're facing for 2019 and beyond?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I think, you know, we've talked a little bit about digital transformation and what we're undergoing in my business and really across Philips. And that's certainly a big topic for us. I think one of the biggest things that I and my team are actually trying to figure out right now is how we work in essentially a two-speed world where you've got kind of legacy systems and processes that are very much kind of waterfall in nature versus other teams in our organization that are working kind of in a scrum agile nature. And how do
for our audience a little bit, can you explain the difference between, you know, what is agile, a little bit about what waterfalls are?
Sure. So waterfall is kind of your tried and true project development methodology where, you know, you'll get a charter and a business case to go off and do some usually very big project. You'll spend a lot of time up front defining requirements. Then you move on to a phase gate, get approval for those requirements. Then you start building out those requirements and so on and so forth. And what you wind up usually having is a fairly long Gantt chart project plan where a number of topics are happening in sequence or together. And you have a number of stage gates throughout the process where you need to kind of check in with your sponsors. And at the end of that project, you deliver something, whether it's a new software product or a physical product or some sort of business process improvement or what have you. Now, there's not necessarily anything wrong with that, but I'll talk about that a little bit in the context of Agile. So Agile is really designed, there's an Agile manifesto that came out in the early 2000s. It's primarily around software development. And the idea there is that where waterfall is very allergic to change, because every time you need to make a change to scope or what have you, you need to re-baseline, re-analyze your business case, bring it back to your sponsors, taking days, weeks, months even to get that done, versus an Agile methodology, which is really designed to be very accepting of and responsive to change. So what that winds up meaning is that you organize teams differently to do the work so that a team has got all the functions on it, whether it's development, product owners, testers, who you name it, to actually deliver a piece of a feature or something of value versus, legacy environments where you have the coding department and then they send it to the QA department and then they send it to the validation department. It all happens kind of in a batch sequenced type of model. Agile is really much more sort of small, iterative, almost single piece flow, if you will, to use a lean term. And so the two of those things really work very differently from each other. Does that help kind of explain the context?
Yeah. So what I'm hearing is that with an agile approach, you have more of a notion of what the end result is going to be, not a very specific detail of what that end result is going to be, and you sort of work towards that notion, snapping it into focus step by step, rather than big bang.
Correct. And I think the real value in agile approaches is that you're delivering value throughout versus waiting to the very end to deliver any value. And so the approach is to kind of take a look at the work. You're not going to have complete requirements. You're going to have good enough requirements to get started. And the teams will work for a sprint, like 2 weeks. And they're very big on time boxing the effort. And so basically, they'll write some what they call user stories, like here's what we want to be able to do, here's what a user will we want to be able to do, and we'll spend 2 weeks and we'll build that thing, test it, and then we'll ship it. And then the next 2 weeks we'll do that again and again and again. And they work off of a backlog of items which can kind of constantly be reprioritized. So if we launch a feature and we find out that it's a dud, we can pull it back. Or if we find that in response to customer feedback that this set of features that may have been lower down on our priority list are telling us they want them sooner, then we have the ability to move those up in the queue and get them done sooner. In waterfall, that's nearly impossible because you've already kind of planned out your resources that you're going to do things in a fixed order, and that anytime you make a change, then you need to introduce kind of this bureaucratic do loop in order to make any kind of change.
Yeah, so it sounds like Agile adheres to the, every plan is solid until it makes first contact with the enemy. Is that
exactly,
basically it?
Exactly. Yeah. And it's baked into the way of working and the whole methodology that you invite those changes, not resist them like an antibody.
Yeah. So beyond 2019, where do you see either your career or the discipline of operational excellence and all its various components, even Agile, where do you see that progressing and evolving?
That's a great question. I think what I still see is what I'll call kind of balkanization out there. So it seems like it comes in waves, and I have a number of colleagues who had done Lean or Six Sigma or continuous improvement at, say, insurance companies or banks or what have you. And it seemed like some of those organizations tried it for a while and then moved away from it. And maybe now they're calling it something else, like digital transformation. Whereas kind of in the sort of manufacturing supply chain world, you still see very much the lean approach is still quite ubiquitous. And that's kind of what I see out in the marketplace. It's largely those firms that are looking for lean expertise. I think the reality that we're all going to need to come to is that, you know, as consumers, we ourselves, we are ever increasingly demanding of those who supply us things. And I think, you know, more and more companies that are going to win in the future are going to have to really orient themselves around very agilely or quickly understanding, discovering that value that customers are looking for, and then delivering it quickly, or else someone else will. And I think that's why you see so much kind of quote unquote disruption from some of these startups, is because they don't have the legacy of kind of an old way of doing things. They can move pretty quickly to take advantage of opportunities that they see in the marketplace. So I think whatever tool set, or, you know, however people want to think about operational excellence, to me, it really has to be oriented around delivering that value proposition very quickly. I was in a class recently, or at a planning session recently, trying to kind of explain a little bit about our digital transformation. I just asked the question, like, how many of you in the room would do business with a bank that made you deposit checks in person at the branch? And one hand went up at about 100 people. And, you know, you
was just my father in the room? Is that my?
But you remember, you know, a couple, I don't know how long it was ago, a year or two ago, three ago, the first company that came out with that, you know, I can take a picture of my check and deposit it. That was really cool. And that was a differentiator. And now very quickly, if your banking app doesn't have that feature, you're like, oh, what's the matter with these people? That everything should be like that. And I think that's kind of the reality that we have to embrace collectively in business, is that that's what customers expect. They expect things to be as easy as an iPhone app that requires no training, no documentation. I can just use it. Not only that, there's even kind of a differentiated expectation between apps. So if my app doesn't work as well as Uber, for example, which is a very nicely working app, I'm not going to be very happy about it. So it really is just now, I see the pace picking up dramatically now that we're in digital economies and digital environments, where the customer is constantly giving you signals about what value they have, what they're looking for, through the tools that they use. And they have many more opportunities and outlets to register their displeasure, whether it's Facebook or Amazon reviews or you name it. And so that's just really, turns things on its side a little bit for incumbents that are used to moving at a much slower pace.
Yeah, I often make the argument that, you know, the competitive differentiator in the 20th century company was the company that had control over its processes, optimized processes, effective and efficient. But that time is the enemy of the 21st century company. And we have to be able to make decisions quicker, and often from incomplete data. And so I think that dovetails very nicely in an agile approach. You know, instead of the big bang, you know, we're making those iterative, progressive steps towards an end state, and being very reactive to the changing circumstances of our environment. In this case, the environment being our customers in the marketplace.
Absolutely, and I think what it really requires is, and this is kind of Lean 101, right? I mean, you talk to Toyota folks, they say, we don't build cars, we build people. And the reading I take away from that is that we're building people who, you know, we're building capability to be curious, to be thinking about different and new ways to do things, about solving problems, so that it's kind of crowdsourced, and that collectively you have an organization that is kind of hardwired, if you will, to learn and adapt, versus, you know, kind of stay stuck. And I think that's really going to be another key differentiator in organizations is how quickly can you foster that learning muscle in people so that you can see what's happening in the marketplace and learn from it and then make the improvements. That's, you know, very fundamental part of Lean. It's a very fundamental part of Agile that it baked into the process is how can we do things better than we did last week? Because it just never stops. And I think, you know, when I think about DMAIC, you know, in Six Sigma, where the C stands for control, I kind of have to laugh now because nothing ever stays the same, right? And so the idea of controlling a process is, in some ways, I mean, you can't have out of control processes, but it's really less about control and it's more about continuing to adapt and to meet the needs that are emerging all the time. I also want to just touch on one thing you talked about with data and incomplete data. I think what I see quite often is in some ways almost the opposite problem. We have too much data and we don't really know how to get intelligence out of it, or we have so much at our disposal that you can really spend quite a lot of time diving into the data and wanting the data to speak to you and tell you the secrets. At the end of the day, it still does require kind of a human intervention to make a call. And in that part, I don't necessarily think goes away, right? You're, even with the emergence of artificial intelligence and machine learning, you know, my view is that it's going to be a difference between people with artificial intelligence and people without, not people versus artificial intelligence.
Yeah. When it comes to data collection and analytics, you know, I often caution people about what data they collect. I mean, obviously we could collect nearly an infinite amount of data. And, you know, in just the types of data that we're collecting. But if we don't really pay attention to it, we get dirty data. Mm-hmm. In other words, if we're collecting data that we really don't care, we're collecting it because it's there, but we really don't care about it, then if there's ever an opportunity to use it, we have to question the validity of that data. You know, but if we're collecting data in a purposeful manner because we want to collect it because we're going to use it, we make an extra effort to make sure that that data is clean as we're collecting it.
That's a really critical point, because I think if you look at, you know, big data was kind of the buzzword a few years ago. And I think, you know, what I saw around me and saw elsewhere is that we had all this data, but because it wasn't kind of sort of created and captured in a structured manner, we really couldn't unlock the power of big data, right? So that's absolutely critical. The other thing that we find is really important in kind of these software as a service models, these digital environments, is that what you've baked into this is that there's kind of a democratization of data, so that no longer does the company have one view that you don't get to see. It's really, you get to see exactly the same as I get to see on the company side as a user. So that really, you know, if you are not purposeful in how you're capturing that data and keeping it clean, you know, a customer looks at their data on your service and says, well, that's not right. It starts to erode confidence in your service if the data that they're capturing on you is not kept collect and clean. So it does raise the game quite a bit when your customers are seeing the same data you are, whereas they weren't able to see that in the past.
Right, good. So listen, we're going to go to the speed round right now. I'm going to ask you a couple of off the beaten path kind of questions, and just give me your gut shot reaction to it.
Sure.
Does it sound right?
Okay,
good. So what's the best piece of advice you ever received?
Best piece of advice I ever received was don't worry about the next job. Focus on doing a great job in the job you're in, and the next job will take care of itself.
And who gave you that piece of advice?
That was my last manager at General Electric, actually, who's gone on to be promoted probably three times since I worked for her.
Oh, super, super. And what's a personal habit that contributes to your success?
I wake up at 6 o'clock in the morning, whether it's Monday or Sunday. and that just works for me. But I think having being an early riser and making use of the best time of day for me, which is morning, is definitely very helpful.
It's funny. It's funny that you say that, because I actually have my favorite poster that I have in my my office here is about the lion and the gazelle, and it says every morning in Africa, a gazelle wakes up. It knows it must run faster than the fastest lion, or it will be killed. And every morning, a lion wakes up. It knows it must outrun the slowest gazelle, or it'll starve to death. So right. It doesn't matter whether you're a lion or a gazelle. When the sun comes up, you better be running.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah. Good. So the last final question, since you're a philosopher, is who is your favorite philosopher and why?
Well, that's a great question, and certainly there are many. I would say the one that really spoke to me the most was a gentleman named Hans-Georg Gadamer, and his probably most famous quote that resonated with me is, "Being that cannot be understood is language." In philosophy, we're always trying to understand the things around us, and being, with a capital B, is probably the most important / difficult thing to understand. And so he reduced it to say, basically, you're only going to be able to understand it as much as you can express it in language. And that was something that always stuck with me.
Yeah, words matter. Words matter. So, well, listen, James, thank you very much for being on the podcast today. It's been a great pleasure. I appreciate you taking the time and effort to join me today.
Oh, thanks, Joseph. It's been a great pleasure myself, and I really appreciate the opportunity.
Great. James Considine, Chief of Staff and Head of Business Programs for the Aging and Caregiving at Philips. Thanks a lot, James.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to State of Readiness. You can discover more episodes and learn about the book written by Joseph Paris of the same title at www.state-of-readiness.com. You can learn more about Joseph Paris at www.josephparis.me/card.